this is Linda L.C. Clemens, and when I want to stay informed, I always listen to Afternoons with Amos on AM 1310, The Light.
During the break, the room got real quiet. Senator Donnelly, who met the president at the airport, is here. Congressman Carson, who rode in on Air Force One, is here. All of a sudden, the security personnel that stand to the right and the left of the president of the United States, and whenever he is at the podium, they are in position. And so that usually means, A, go to your soft voice if you're an announcer wherever the president of the United States is. And it also means that literally any second now, the program will begin. I understand that a student from Ivy Tech will give the welcome to everyone that is here. We'll introduce Mayor Greg Ballard, who will introduce the president of the United States. And that's kind of what it is in that particular order. But it looks like those who traveled with the president are here, and that includes Congressman Carson, who rode out from Washington on Air Force One. Other members of the media are plugging in, plugging up, ready to rock and roll. So everybody is in place. You could hear a pin drop in the crowd. So everybody now is awaiting the arrival of the president momentarily. And again, I think what we're looking for to, in terms of, will not only, obviously the president is going to talk about community colleges and his proposal talked about in the State of the Union. Obviously the president will talk about his how that fits into his plan for the banner that is middle class economics. But also one of the questions is the president going to touch on the positive economic news of the day in terms of the number of Americans, the number of jobs created in January of this year, increasing. The unemployment rate 5.7%, but the number of Americans employed went up, number of Americans unemployed went down. And I think that's one of the other questions that we're going to be looking to see, will the president talk about that? And then the other thing is, what kinds of questions will this audience here at Ivy Tech, somewhere between 250 and 300, including maybe 75 to 80 students at Ivy Tech Community College, who are very, very excited with the opportunity to talk directly to the leader of the free world, to the president of the United States, first presidential visit to Ivy Tech. And then in the room are a number of members of the Indiana General Assembly of both political parties. The Lieutenant Governor of Indiana is here, obviously the mayor, several members of the Indianapolis City County Council, former gubernatorial candidate John Gregg, former Congressman Barron Hill, Senator Joe Donnelly is here, Congressman Carson is here, Teresa Lubbers, the head of the Indiana Commission on Higher Education. Again, a number of figures now, and they're trying to make sure that every seat is full. When we say people are jam-packed in here, they are jam-packed in here. Again, the president was scheduled to speak at 2:15. We are reasonably certain that he is in the house, that he is in the building. They're now about 6 minutes behind their original schedule. So now we're just really waiting for the program to start. It had its official start about a half an hour ago with the Pledge of Allegiance and the singing of the Star Spangled Banner, and then this long lull with kind of soft music being played in the background. And now just waiting. It's the waiting game. The people who have been here sitting in this ballroom have been here since 11:30 this morning. So it is almost a 3 hour wait for them to see the president, not just the students at Ivy Tech, but many of the local and state officials who are here. The superintendent of public instruction, Glenda Ritz, is also here in the house. IMPD Chief Rick Height. I'm looking over. I'm trying to get the highest. Is he here? Okay. I just kind of thought so. Chief of Police says the president is somewhere in the. It's like Elvis. He's in the building. So the key is, let's get the introduction. and let's get this thing on the road. Again, the still photographers are milling around trying to make sure they get their particular pictures that they need. People are getting seated, getting comfortable. Chief of Police is walking around. He looks cool, so everything is particularly close. Again, this is the second time that this program has been privileged to air an address by the President of the United States. The last time was in July of 2005 when President George W. Bush came to give the keynote address at the Indiana Black Expo Summer Celebration Luncheon and receive a prestigious award. Then that was the first time that WTLC ever broadcast a live address by a President of the United States in a visit to this city, to this community, and the first time our program was privileged to do that. During the presidential campaign in 2008, President Barack Obama was on this program a number of times. We broadcast live from several campaign rallies where he participated that occurred during our broadcast hours. We also broadcast a rally by his then Democratic opponent, Senator Hillary Clinton. But this will be the first time that we will have a address by the President of the United States. They're now testing out the cameras to make sure that all of the cameras in the video feed works. The video feed today is very interesting. Fox News Network is what is considered the pool broadcaster. The pool broadcaster has the responsibility of setting up cameras to shoot the event and provide those pictures to all of the television networks and local stations that wish to use them. So the pool broadcaster is Fox, and that is a responsibility that rotates around the major networks, Fox, CNN, NBC, CBS, ABC. And it just happens to be Fox's day to do that. On Mondays, Afternoons with Amos, the folks from the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library will be with us to preview their annual Meet the Artist celebration that occurs during Black History Month. And that's one of the highlights that will be on our program on Wednesday. I can see in the background that Senator Donnelly is getting a picture taken with his predecessor, Senator Dick Lugar. Senator Lugar accompanied the president this morning from Washington on Air Force One. And I'm willing to bet that Senator Lugar shared some wisdom with the president on issues of foreign policy. Again, Senator Donnelly, you know, talking to some of the spectators that are here, taking that picture with Senator Lugar. And again, we're running a little behind the original scheduled time of the president's remarks. We're not sure once the president takes the podium how long his initial remarks will be before he goes to a town hall Q&A. That is something that we really have not gotten any kind of good guidance or indication from the White House about. Or White House aides that are here. That's going to be one of the things that we're going to be watching and listening for this afternoon. But again, the crowd is ready. They're psyched. The students that are sitting behind the president, that's not easy in the world. You're sitting in, there's three rows of folks that are sitting behind the president. And they will be the ones that are in camera shot, camera angle the whole time, so they can't fall asleep. They got to stay awake the whole time. And this crowd of about 300, a bipartisan crowd. This is not a partisan Democratic crowd. And there are people also lined along the wall. So this literally is a packed house as we wait. We know the president is in the building, probably, you know, meeting with officials of Ivy Tech as well as the mayor and meeting the person that will open this program and live coverage of the president's remarks here in Indianapolis at Ivy Tech. First time that a president of the United States has spoken at the community college system for the state of Indiana. The Ivy Tech system. Ivy Tech has worked with the White House as the White House has worked to encourage all of the 50 states of this country, that includes the District of Columbia, to have strong community college systems. And it was just a few years ago when the United States did, when Indiana did not have a strong community college system. And it's only been in the last few years that this state has really built Ivy Tech with campuses literally from Lake Michigan all the way down to the Ohio River to educate more students than any institution of higher learning here in the state of Indiana, and having the largest percentage of African American and minority students of any institution of higher learning within the state of Indiana. So to have the President of the United States come to Ivy Tech, even though he's talking about the broader issue of the importance of community college in growing the American economy, the fact that he's at this particular institution is a tribute to Ivy Tech, as well as a lift up for the city of Indianapolis and a lift up for the state of Indiana. The governor met with the president when he arrived at Indianapolis International Airport now almost an hour ago. The president landed literally. Here we go.
Please welcome Mayor Greg Ballard.
The mayor now is coming to the podium. White shirt, dark suit, red tie. Here's the mayor.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. I'm delighted to be here to welcome the President Barack Obama to the city of Indianapolis. Mr. President, from your first days in office, you forged a unique friendship with Hoosiers, especially those of us who call Indianapolis home. We have worked together through some tough economic challenges, and one thing has always been clear. You understand the issues that cities face. In 2010, more than $20 million in federal Tiger Grant funding poured into our city to complete the Indianapolis Cultural Trail, and this 8-mile linear park has since spurred hundreds of millions of dollars in new development. In 2014, when we brought forward a proposal for the nation's first all-electric bus rapid transit line, your team was there to assist. At the state level, I know that Governor Pence has worked with your administration to introduce the Healthy Indiana Plan 2.0. It's an innovative, affordable health insurance program that will cover roughly 350,000 uninsured Hoosiers, many of them right here in Marion County. And finally, as cities work to halt the disturbing pattern of violence that threatens to rob us of an entire generation of young people, the My Brother's Keepers initiative is more than welcome. By working together, we are better equipped to connect youth with opportunities from high-quality pre-K all the way to post-secondary education and meaningful career paths for young adults. Mr. President, your partnership and shared vision for our community continue to shape Indianapolis into a thriving global city. And it has been a great honor and a privilege to work with you on so many important programs. Now, despite the fact that you are a Chicago Bulls fan, it is with great enthusiasm that I welcome you to the city of Indianapolis. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me in welcoming the President of the United States, Barack Obama!
Great introduction by the President of the United States. He enters in. He is without a suit coat, sleeve rolled up, white blue shirt, blue and white striped tie. Shakes hands with the mayor. Now
thank
the President
you,
of the United States, Barack
thank
Obama.
Thank you. Hello, Hoosiers. Thank you so much. Well, please, everybody have a seat. Have a seat. Let me begin by saying thank you to Mayor Ballard for that introduction, for all the great work you're doing for the people of Indianapolis, and for your service as a Marine. We are very proud of the partnership that we've had with this city. I also want to recognize Ivy Tech Chancellor Kathleen Lee and President Tom Schneider. Where are they? Right here. All over here. Some outstanding members of Congress. Joe Donnelly, our senator. Where's Joe? There he is. Congressman Andre Carson. And somebody who has been a great friend for the people of this state, the people of this nation, a great friend to me personally, one of the people who have ensured that America's safe for so many years, former Senator and Mayor of Indianapolis, Dick Lugar. So. On the way over here, Dick and I were reminiscing about the first foreign trip I ever took was with Dick Lugar. He was the savvy veteran. I was the green behind the ears freshman. We went to Russia. We were both interested in nuclear proliferation. He had really written the book on it. Dick Lugar seems like a kind of a relaxed guy, but if you're on a trip with him, he will wear you out. And then at one point we were actually held by a Russian court for about 3 hours, which normally might have made people nervous, but Dick, you know, he'd been around the block a few times, so he just took a nap. It was fine. It got cleared up. It is great to be back in Indiana, great to be back close to my home state. I respect the Pacers. But yes, I am a Bulls fan. I make no apologies. We've had some fierce rivalries in the past. And I'm looking forward to Mr. George and others getting back on track so we can have some more playoff runs. But that's not all that I know about this state. One of my first trips as president was to Elkhart. And I stopped by some of your manufacturing plants. I played 3-on-3 at a school up in Kokomo, and my team won, by the way. When it comes to elections, I'm batting 500. I'm 1-for-2, which isn't bad. I got kind of smoked here in Indiana. But that's okay. That's exactly why I wanted to come back. And I don't plan to take too long in the front because I want to make sure that we've got some time for questions. But, you know, when I gave my State of the Union address a couple of weeks ago, I repeated a vision that I originally laid out in Boston over a decade ago. And that's a vision that says there is no liberal America or conservative America. There's the United States of America. And I know that sometimes it seems like our politics are more divided than ever, that in parts of Indiana the only blue you'll ever see is on Colts signs, and in Chicago the only red is for the Chicago Bulls. But I still believe what I said back then, that you know, we actually have so much more in common than not. It doesn't always get focused on in our politics, and I've seen so much of the good, generous, big-hearted optimism of people across the country these past 6 years to give in to the cynicism that sometimes gets peddled as wisdom around the country. And we've come a long way these past 6 years since we suffered the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Now, this morning we found out that America's businesses added another 267,000 jobs. In 2014, our economy created more than 3.1 million jobs, and that's the best year of job growth since the 1990s. So, all told, over the past 59 months, the private sector has added about 11.8 million, so that's almost 12 million new jobs. That's the longest streak of private sector job growth in our history. Meanwhile, our deficits are shrinking. They've gone down by about two-thirds. Our dropout rates are down. Our graduation rates are up. We're as free of foreign oil as we've been in 30 years. We've doubled the amount of clean energy that we're producing. A lot of families are saving a lot of money at the gas pump, which is putting some smiles on folks' faces. And no, you're welcome. I mean, it's although I was telling somebody the other day, at some point they're going to go back up, so don't start, you know, going out there and ignoring, you know, the mileage on when you're buying a new car. You know, so you got to keep looking for those savings. And in the single most hopeful sign for middle class families, wages are starting to go up again. And so America is poised for another good year. Indianapolis is poised for another good year, as long as Washington works to keep this progress going. And I was struck as I was listening to the mayor's introduction. You know, here in Indiana, we've been able to do some good things because we haven't been so worried about Democrat, Republican, and we've focused more on trying to get the job done. And that attitude we're hoping to kind of infect Washington with, try to adapt that same attitude when it comes to the problems that we face going forward. And Dick Lugar was a great example of that. You know, we have written... we have risen from recession freer to write our own future than any nation on earth. But we've got to make some decisions about what that future looks like. Are we going to be a nation where a few of us do spectacularly well and everybody else is struggling to get by? Or are we going to have a country in which everybody has opportunity? Everybody's got a chance to succeed. Last year, you know, I got a letter from Jillian Milham, who lives up in Fishers. Where's Jillian? There she is, right there, right in front. And Jillian's got four kids, ages 6 through 16, which means that, you know, she's busy. For 13 years, Jillian was a stay-home mom. A few years ago, she was going through a divorce, had to find a way to support her family. She didn't have a college degree. Most of the jobs that she could find paid minimum wage. As she put it, I was a mom with four kids and I had everything coming against me. So Jillian came here to Ivy Tech to invest in herself, to learn new skills. She paid her way with the help of a grant from her country and a grant from the state of Indiana. She made the dean's list, earned a spot in the radiography program at IUPUI. And that's a profession that pays pretty well. And today, she's a few months from graduating. She's ready to get started on a new career. And I'm really proud. And, you know, in the letter she wrote, she said, you know, it's not just the possibility of financial security and career advancement. She said, it's also something I can show my children. You know, it's about pride, and it's about being able to point to a brighter future for the next generation. And that's who I get up for every single day. You know, sometimes people ask me, Mr. President, your hair is so gray. Yeah, you know, folks are always talking about you, not always in the most flattering way. How do you do it? Well, the reason is folks like Jillian, you know, who are out there all across Indiana, all across the country. They're working so hard, doing the right thing, not asking for a handout. They just want to make sure that if they are putting in the effort and they're meeting their responsibilities, that they can get ahead.
And we can't do it for them, but we can help. We can create structures of opportunity like we have here at Ivy Tech. That's something we can do for everybody. And that's what keeps me going. And I want to make sure that this is a country where hard work is rewarded. And you get a chance to make a decent living. And that's what I've been calling middle class economics is all about. The idea that in this country, everybody does best when everybody's doing their fair share. And everybody's got a fair shot. And everybody's playing by the same set of rules. You know, we live in a time of constant change, and technology's made some jobs obsolete. Global competition has shipped some jobs overseas. It's tougher to afford economic necessities like childcare or healthcare. And that's been true since long before the financial crisis hit back in 2007-2008. And that's why at a time when the economy is finally picking up steam and growing again, we got to work twice as hard, especially in Washington, to help more Americans like Jillian. So this week I sent Congress a budget that's built on this idea of middle-class economics for the 21st century. It means helping middle-class families afford child care and health care, making it a little easier to pay for college without taking on loads of debt, paid leave at work, helping first-time homebuyers, helping people save for retirement. And my budget addresses each of these issues, and it could put thousands of dollars back in the pockets of hard-working middle-class families. Middle-class economics also means helping more people like Jillian upgrade their skills, because this competitive economy is not going to get easier. You know, folks just aren't going to be in the same job for 30 years. These young people who are here today, they're going to have a bunch of different jobs. And there's going to be the need for you to continually upgrade your skills. It's all about lifelong learning now, not just a one-time deal. So that's why my budget makes 2 years of community college free for every responsible student. Every responsible student. Because here in America, it shouldn't matter how much money your folks make. If you're willing to work hard, you should be able to get that opportunity. And you shouldn't necessarily have $100,000 worth of debt when you leave, especially if you're going to go into a profession like teaching. And we're not just working to make community colleges free. Like Ivy Tech, we want to make our community colleges even better and more responsive. And more attuned to what's going on in the marketplace. Right here at this school, one of the best in the country, not just in the state of Indiana. You're finding ways to raise graduation rates and partner with businesses to help provide apprenticeships and other pathways to careers that pay well in fields like construction and technology. Middle-class economics also means that we're investing in what makes our economy grow. Better roads, faster internet, cutting-edge research so that our businesses are creating high-paying jobs. And the good news is we can actually afford to pay for all this. We don't have to add to our deficits if we've got some smart spending cuts and if we fix a tax code that is filled up with special interest loopholes and kickbacks for folks who don't need them. You know, and in my budget, I identify some of these. There's a trust fund loophole that allows the wealthiest 1% of Americans who have benefited more over the last 20 years than anybody from when the economy has been growing. But this trust fund loophole allows the top 1% of Americans to avoid paying taxes on their unearned income. You know, that's not something that Jillian, when she gets her job, is going to be able to do. Majority of people here can't avoid paying taxes.
don't know why the folks who are most able to pay them should be able to avoid it. So we need to fix that. And then we can use the savings to cut taxes for middle-class families who really need it. You know, we know that there are companies that have stashed about $2 trillion overseas that haven't paid U.S. taxes. Let's close those loopholes. Make it more attractive for businesses to locate here in the United States of America. Let's give those folks a tax break. They'll create jobs right here in Indianapolis, right here in Indiana, as opposed to giving tax breaks to folks that are shipping jobs overseas or parking money overseas. We can do that. So these are ideas that are pretty common sense. Now, in Washington, folks saw the budget. They said, well, these are Obama's plans. Some of them are pretty good ideas, but they're never going to go anyplace because the Republicans control Congress and they're not going to do it. Well, you know, I'm not pushing these ideas for my sake. I'm pushing them because I think this is where America needs to go. And we should have a healthy debate about how to do the things that are necessary to help America grow. You know, Republicans and Democrats won't agree on everything, and that's fine. But we should agree on the stuff we're talking about now. We should agree that hardworking families should be able to get child care that's not more expensive than sending a kid to college. We should agree that somebody like Jillian, who wants to better herself, should be able to go to college without being loaded up with even more debt. We should be willing to agree that a great city like Indianapolis needs to keep its infrastructure in good shape in order to attract new businesses so they feel confident that they can get their products and services out to market, and that we've got the best trained workforce in the world, because that's what's going to make companies want to locate here. Those are things we can agree on. We should agree that the tax code should be fair, and nobody should be treated better just because they got better accountants or better lawyers. So if Republicans disagree with the way I'm trying to solve these problems, they should put forward their own plans, and I am happy to look at it. But what we can't do is ignore the problems and pretend that they don't matter. Pretend that families aren't out there struggling, doing their best. I believe in a crazy thing Dick Ruger once wrote. Dick said, the other party is also patriotic and may have good ideas. That's shocking. I know Mayor Ballard believes the same thing, and certainly I do. So let's roll up our sleeves, work together, and try to get some stuff done. That's what all of you elected us to do. Not to turn everything into a Washington food fight. Not to just refight the old partisan battles. Let's have a debate that's worthy of this country and build on an economy that is picking up steam and make sure that it is serving everybody. That prosperity is broad-based. That not only everybody is sharing in America's success, but everybody's contributing to America's success. That's what we're trying to do. So that's what's on my mind. Now I want to hear what's on your mind. All right? So we're going to start taking some questions. And the way this is going to work is really simple. You raise your hand. I will call on you. And if you could stand up, introduce yourself. Try to keep your question relatively short. I'll try to keep my answer relatively short. In fact, the only rule I'm going to impose is I'm going to go girl, boy, to make sure it's even. Make sure it's fair. All right? Okay, let's get started. Who wants to go first? This young lady right here.
Hi, I'm Erica Walsh with the College Democrats of Indiana. I was curious how you think offering 2-year free community college will impact universities with traditional 4-year college.
Well, I think a lot of folks are going to still use the traditional pathway of going to a 4-year university. And if that's your best option, God bless you. That's great. There's always going to be a market for Indiana University or Notre Dame. It's not like suddenly people are going to stop wanting to go there. But what the 2 years of free community college potentially does is for somebody who's cash strapped, their best option may be, let me go get 2 years in a community college. I may have already at that point gotten the training I need to go out into the workforce and get a good paying job. Or if I decide that I want to continue with my education, I can now transfer to a four-year institution with those credits, which means that the amount of tuition I'm paying at the four-year university is going to be reduced. Either way, you are saving money. And this is part of what we need to do to be more creative about how do young people get the skills they need without spending as much money or taking on as much debt. This isn't the only kind of thing we're looking at. For example, and I think Ivy Tech is looking at this kind of partnership with high schools. A number of community colleges now are linking up with high schools where you can start taking college credits in high school so that by the time you get to the community college, you've already got some credits, which reduces the amount of time that you have to spend in the community college, and that'll save you money too. So the point is that we have this very rigid system. We have this image in our heads. Okay, you go through high school, and then right away you go to a four-year university. And instead, what we should be thinking about is how do we create, from the time you are in ninth grade all the way until the time that you've got a job, how do we make sure you're able to get the best skills possible at the cheapest cost? And if there are faster pathways to do that, let's use those faster pathways. If there are cheaper ways to do that, let's find ways to reduce cost. Let's use technology in some cases. I mean, online learning is getting better and better and better. And are there ways in which, particularly, say, somebody who's a mom and has an irregular schedule and can't be on a campus all day, are there ways that she can get some credits while still looking after a family or working part-time? So we just have to be much more creative about these issues. The one thing that, in addition to being creative, we have to remember is that state legislators have a responsibility to make sure that state institutions are still getting the support that they need, because part of what's happened... Part of the reason that the cost of higher education has gone up so rapidly is that state support for those institutions has gone down or not kept up with inflation. So what happens is then school administrators have to make up for it with higher tuition. Now, the school administrators, they have a responsibility to be more efficient. And students and parents, we have a responsibility to be smart consumers. You know, I joked with Malia and Sasha, because Malia's now at the age where she's starting to look at colleges, and I said, you know, these days I hear everybody's looking for fancy gyms and gourmet food and, you know, really spiffy dorms. And let me tell you, when I was at college, you know, the college I started at, Occidental College, it did have a gym, but like the weight room was, you know, it was like a medicine ball, and you know, it wasn't fancy. It wasn't state of the art. Cafeteria, I don't remember some of the stuff they served there, but I remember it wasn't that appetizing. I do know there was something on the menu that we called roast beast, because we couldn't really tell what kind of meat it was. It was some sort of meat product. So, students and parents have to be better consumers. The universities have to figure out how to become more efficient and also give information to young people ahead of time, because part of what happens these days is in recruiting students, they'll say, don't worry about it, you'll be able to afford it. Well, it's true that in part because we've expanded Pell Grants and we cut out the bank middleman on student loans so that we could give more student loans, that a lot of young people are able to finance college that they couldn't do before. But if they don't know ahead of time that when you get out, you may have a $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 bill, then that's a problem. So we got to provide them better information. But ultimately, what also has to happen is state legislators have to step up. The federal government will do its part. And we've expanded the support we're giving to students. But these public institutions have a special obligation, and it is a good investment. Because the states with the best educational system, that's where companies are going to go. It's true not just in this country, it's true all across the world. All right? Okay. It's the gentleman's turn.
This is
this young man right here.
White
shirt. I'm not sure we got a mic back here, but
of the president's address, his question and answers at IU.
How loud are you? Are you able to just shout? No? All right, it's kind of a soft-spoken guy. Here we go.
Hi, I'm Mario Keisman, an ASAP student here at Ivy Tech. My question is, if community college does become free, do you feel as if the value of having an associate's degree will begin to drop?
Absolutely not. But I think it's a good question. I've been asked this question before. I don't know where this is coming from. I'll tell you a story, or I'll give you an example. There is a college in New York called City Colleges of New York. And back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, the City Colleges of New York produced as many Nobel laureates as a lot of Ivy League schools. It was free. But it was considered one of the best universities in the country, one of the best college systems in the country. Nobody thought, well, because you went to the City Colleges and it didn't cost you any money, that somehow the education was devalued. So the issue is not whether you're, how much money you're paying. The issue is what kind of education is it providing you? And the reputation of the school is going to be determined by when the graduates come out, do they have the skills they need to do the job? And if they do, then employers are going to know it, because employers are hungry for well-qualified students. I can't tell you how many businesses I talk to where they say our biggest problem is we can't find enough workers who are trained in the fields that we're searching for. So I don't let anybody think that paying more means a better education. One thing that we do have to think about, and this is where the community colleges can be an outstanding bridge, is making sure that we're reaching out to businesses and finding out what do they need for the positions that they're hiring, and having those businesses help community colleges design training programs and departments to serve those needs. And we're seeing a lot more work done by community colleges on that front. And Ivy Tech does a great job also with apprenticeships in partnership with Labor Council. That's another example of smart education. Turns out the average apprentice gets a $50,000 starting salary once they get out of apprenticeship, on average across the country. So we're doing a lot to encourage schools to expand apprenticeships and partnerships. But, don't think paying more is better. Paying less is better. I'm always looking for a deal. All right. Let's see. Yes, right there. Yeah, hold, Mike's coming right there.
Yes, my name is Amy Saxton.
Hold on, Amy.
Oh, sure.
Here we go.
Thank you. My name is Amy Saxton, and my question is, I pay for my daughter's college. I'm now saving for my grandchildren's college with a 529 plan.
Right.
Do you see any changes that might impact me as I go into retirement?
You know, we initially looked at changing the 529 plan. And the reason is that I have 529s for both. For those who aren't familiar, 529 is basically a savings account that you can put in tax-free up to a certain amount for savings for your child's college. The problem is when you looked at the statistics, the folks who used them most were folks who were a little more on the high end. A lot of people couldn't use them because they just weren't generating enough savings to be able to take advantage of the benefit. And so our thinking was, you could save money by eliminating the 529 and shifting it into some other loan programs that would be more broadly based. But I think enough people, and we were going to hold harmless folks like you or me who already have money in 529, so it wasn't as if suddenly you had to start paying taxes on it. But just going forward, we were going to change it. I'll be honest with you. There were enough people who already were utilizing 529s that they started feeling as if, well, you know, changing like this in midstream, even if I'm not affected right now, I like the program. It wasn't worth it for us to eliminate it. The savings weren't that great. So we actually, based on response, changed our mind and are going to be paying for the 2 years of free community college with other sources, including some of the tax loopholes that we're closing. So, short answer to your question is 529s will not change at this point. Okay. Got a gentleman here who's really has a question right here. He was waving and everything. This is going to be a good one.
It's going to be a good one.
No, that's right.
What's My name is Eddie White with the Indiana Pacers.
Oh, good to talk to you, man.
Basketball is really important in this state. You know, we have this saying, in 49 states, it's just basketball, but this is Indiana. Years ago, on a radio show, you told me that when I asked you about your game, you said you were a poor man's Tayshaun Prince. Where is your game today? And one more thing, Tamika Catching says she's ready one-on-one anytime you want.
All right. Well, let me make a couple of points here. First of all, I love Tamika. She refereed the game we played in Kokomo, so she was a witness to my domination on the court. But when it comes to me playing her one-on-one at this point, I'm not sure. Because I'll be honest with you, my game's a little broke. I've been a little busy. And what happens is that sort of the risk-reward ratio starts shifting. Like the chances of an Achilles tear or an ACL injury is increasing each month. And then the satisfaction that I get from playing diminishes because I'm so bad. And so I think golf, likelihood of injury much lower. But I still love the game. I still love the game. And this is a good time for me to give a shout-out to the NBA. Mayor Ballard mentioned the work that he's doing with my brother's keepers. And this is something that we initiated in response to all the negative news that we were hearing about young African-American men and Latino men and their interactions with police. And we said, all right, there are a whole bunch of issues that we have to deal with on the criminal justice side, but we have to have an affirmative agenda to make sure that young people feel hope and opportunity and pathways. And so so the idea of My Brother's Keepers is that we are working with both the private sector and the public sector all across the country on mentorship programs. You know, the mayor's talking to folks about doing a 0-3 program because we know that if you invest early in young people, they are much more likely to succeed in school. We know that there's certain points in time where kids are more likely to drop out or more likely to get in trouble with the criminal justice system, and so figuring out interventions. We know that if they're reading at grade level in the third grade, then they're much more likely to graduate, so making sure that we're really concentrating on reading skills at that level. And the interest and involvement has surprised even me. People have been really generous and stepped up to the plate. And the NBA is participating. Some of you who've been watching the games may have seen some of the ads of some of the players talking directly to the TV screen and saying to young people they matter. And so I just want to commend them for the great work they're doing on that front. Commissioner Silver has been very good on it. So we appreciate it. All righty. Let's see. Young lady way in the back. Right there. Yeah, you. Hold on 1 second, though. Wait for the mic to come.
Hold it. Okay, I just want to get this right, so I'm going to read it off. Hi, my name is Isabel Keller.
But you don't have to talk that fast.
Oh, okay, I'll go slowly. Okay. I'm sorry.
You're just kind of nervous.
Yeah.
Okay.
A little bit.
Yeah.
My name is Isabel Keller, and I'm the junior class president at my high school, and I'm co-chairing a bipartisan event at my school next year to help engage high school students in our political process. What advice do you have in helping attract high school students and get them more engaged, like, in our country's politics?
That's great. See, I love young leaders like this. They're juniors in high school taking an interest. Make sure one of our volunteers gets, what's your name again? Isabel? Okay. Let's get Isabel's, email and maybe I'll send her a note for the, to kick off the event next year. But the, One of the big challenges we have in this country is the lack of civic engagement, the lack of participation. In the last election, only about a third of people who were eligible to vote voted. A third! And, you know, you have elections that take place, for example, in Ukraine, where they're in the middle of a war, and their participation rates are 60%. And here, with all the blessings that we've got, the notion that only a third of us would vote that are eligible doesn't make any sense. And so it starts at a young age. And I think the most important thing is, in any bipartisan event like that, is to help young people understand that politics is not some sideshow in Washington. It's not some cable chatter yakking, arguing. It's how we, together, as a community, make decisions about our priorities. What do we think is important? You know, when you're in a junior in high school, if you're like Malia, if you decide you and your friends are going out, you got to make all kinds of decisions about where we're going to eat and what movie do you want to see, and you guys take votes and you're trying to figure out maybe one of your friends doesn't have enough money, and, you know, are we going to chip in to help make sure she can go too? And well, the same thing is true for a country. We got to make priorities. We got to make decisions. You know, are we going to invest in schools? Are we going to make sure that when you graduate you can afford to go to college? Are we going to make sure that we're investing in the research that creates new medicines that will help cure cancer or Parkinson's disease? Are we going to make sure that we're treating our veterans the way they need to be treated when they come home? How are we going to pay for that? Who's going to pay for that? Are we going to make sure that we're passing on an environment that with clean air and clean water? And how are we going to do that? And how are we going to balance that with making sure that we're growing an economy so when you graduate from college, there's a job for you? Well, those are all the things that that politics determines. So I think more than anything, just helping young people understand that this stuff matters to them. And that government is not something separate from you. It is you. In a democracy, it's you that makes these decisions. And then making sure you got good pizza at the event is also important. All right. Who's next? Young man right here. Right here. Thank you.
Hi, I am Mark. Oh, first I want to say thank you for all the things you're doing and the things that you're going to do for our nation. Secondly,
thank you. Yes.
My name is Mark Kelly. I'm actually currently the president of the ASAP organization. And my question is, what is the criteria and the requirements for this plan that you're trying to propose?
For which plan?
For 2 years free of college, yes.
The idea would be that you would have to maintain at least a 2.5 average. So, we're not gonna, I mean, there's no such thing as a completely free lunch. We want to reward people who are making the effort. Because one of the problems we have when it comes to college educations is that young people aren't graduating fast enough. They're dragging things out too long. And that just adds costs. And even if they, you know, are taking out loans, so, you know, it's technically they're paying for it. The problem is that the more expensive it gets, the less likely it may be that they can pay it back. So what we're saying is you've got to earn it. You've got to have a 2.5 average. You've got to, you know, maintain attendance. You've got to stay on a schedule and have a game plan at the front end so that you graduate on time. And obviously there'd be, you know, special circumstances like illness or what have you, but the point is this is not you get 2 years of free goofing off. This is to help you achieve your goals, but that means that you have to put in the effort. All right, so that would be the main criteria. All right. Yes, right here. Hold on a second. Mike's coming.
My name is Christy Lee Vickers. I am an OIF veteran from the U.S. Army, and I'm also the president of the Ivy Tech Collegiate Veterans Organization.
Hey, what branch were you in?
I was in the Army and I was a mechanic.
Army strong.
Whoa.
All right.
Now, my question is, veterans get to use the GI Bill. They also get voc rehab if they are underemployed or if they use their GI Bill or if their GI Bill, if they were a Cold War veteran, they never got that.
Right.
How does this affect a veteran's use of education? Because veterans today are dealing with unemployment rates higher than other people. They are dealing with unemployment altogether. And what's really important is getting a veteran who is dealing with post-traumatic stress or other problems to get an education and have people who understand the fact that they have issues, but at the same time, they have benefits that they've earned and they've paid for through blood and tears.
Right. Well, first of all, thank you for your service. We're proud of you. For those who qualify under the post-9/11 GI Bill, you're already supposed to be getting the benefits that you have earned. And so nothing would change about that program. As you point out, it's not just college tuition, though, that is often a burden on our veterans. So I am very proud of the fact that I have increased veterans funding more than any administration since I've been in office. And a lot of it is focused on some of the challenges that you talk about. For example, we made it much easier for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder to qualify under disability claims. We expanded significantly the number of mental health facilities that were available. We set up, for example, special programs for
women veterans because they've got different medical needs through the VA system. Another example that's really important is we've been working with states and local governments around issues of licensing. So you said you were a mechanic. You know, there may be in a lot of states licensing requirements for you to be a mechanic or to be EMS officer or to be a nurse. And what we were finding was is that I still remember I had a conversation with a guy up in Minnesota. This is when I first came into office. We're at a little diner, sitting down. He had just come back from Iraq. You know, he had two or three tours in Iraq, and you can imagine what an emergency medic in Iraq is dealing with in 2006 or 2007. He decided he wanted to make a career as a nurse. He was having to come back, and he was having to start with nursing 101. I mean, he had to start from scratch. As if he didn't have this incredible wealth of experience and skill. And so we set out to work with state legislators and cities and others that oftentimes are responsible for licensing to say there's got to be transferability and credit for the incredible work that veterans do on the job so that they don't have to start all over again and take a whole bunch of new classes just to get certified on stuff they already know how to do. And that's been really helpful as well. The key now is to get more employers to recognize the skills of our veterans. So Michelle and Jill Biden, through their Joining Forces program, have been able to recruit companies all across the country. You know, major corporations like Honeywell, smaller companies, to not just do job fairs, but make concrete commitments. We are going to hire a certain number of veterans, a certain number of military spouses, and hundreds of thousands of folks have come through these programs. The challenge that we've still got is that we've got to find ways for veterans to upgrade their skills through this process, and that's where things like apprenticeships and so that folks aren't just getting hired at the bottom rungs, but have the opportunity to maybe come in at a higher wage and a higher salary. So we've got to tie together the education process with the hiring process.